This is the Dreamers Podcast, where dreamers share their stories to inspire you. Now, join host Joe Pardo as he interviews a dreamer who's living their dreams.
Welcome to the Dreamers Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Pardo, and today I am interviewing Patrick Roan, who is living his dream through writing. Welcome to the show, Patrick.
Hey, Joe. Thanks for having me on. I love doing stuff like this.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate you getting back to me and wanting to come on the show.
Yeah. Well, and I appreciate you putting up with my ever-changing schedule. This past week or so has just been crazy, crazy nutso busy, lots of projects, lots of changes. I'm doing another GoRuck challenge on Friday night, so I haven't even started preparing for that, really. So no, that's not true. I've been preparing for months, but the kind of final detail stuff I have to do yet. Oh well, enough about my life.
Well, the whole show's about your life.
Oh shit. Yeah, man. Oh gosh, that's pressure.
What is the challenge?
GoRuck Challenge. The GoRuck Challenge is a military-style endurance event led by ex and current Special Forces personnel, put on by a company called GoRuck that make military-grade backpacks, otherwise known as rucksacks, and other equipment. It was started by a Special Forces operator who came back from the field not finding equipment that would stand up to the unique challenges that Special Forces operators go through. And so he decided to design and build one himself and start a company around that. The problem is, of course, that this stuff has to get tested, and there's a couple ways you can test it. You can actually give it to your Special Forces buddies, and they can, you know, have it out in the field and stuff like that. But actually getting that kind of immediate feedback from them is really difficult. And so he decided to get a few of his SPF buddies together, SFO, and throw on these rucks and load them up with heavy stuff and put them through some unique challenges. And one thing grew to another, and now it's an event that is pretty much a business in and of itself. They run GoRuck challenges several every weekend all around the country of various grades. There's the original straight challenge, which is the one that I do, which is a nice guided tour of the city in which it's held. So you'll go anywhere between 15 and 20 miles over the course of anywhere between 13 and 17 hours overnight, starting at 9 p.m. and going overnight to the next late morning, early afternoon.
Oh, wow.
And the whole time you're wearing a pack that is at least 40 to 45 pounds. You are doing all sorts of things. It usually starts out with a three-hour, what they call a welcome party, which is about 3 hours of mixed PT. So, you know, push-ups, sit-ups, burpees, bodybuilders, other ingenious little torture tests that they've come up with, like the Tunnel of Love, where you basically are doing chair stands with your pack in front of you while the guy on the end goes and crawls through your legs and butt, says you're in the chair stand back-to-back up against each other. Oh, no, I'm sorry. That's not Tunnel of Love. That's like a modified – I forget what they call that. The Tunnel of Love is where you're actually in bear crawl position, basically doing a down dog arch, and you've got the folks on the end crawl through, and when you get to the other side, they form the next part of that arch, and it just keeps going like that until they tell you to stop. So, yeah, this is – it's the – one of the most physically and mentally challenging events available today.
Have you always been into physically challenging events?
Absolutely not. Nope. this is something that I got into thanks to my friend Yuri, mainly. He was the first one to turn me on to it, my friend Yuri in Boston. And Yuri is a really unique guy, a really interesting guy. I'm not going to say too much about him here, but he's awesome. And then my friend Eric convinced me to give it a shot. He did one. I actually broke my foot training for the one that we were supposed to do together, but then ended up doing another one a few months later after my foot healed. It's good. And what's interesting is that once you do it, you kind of form a friendship and bond with these strangers that you've never met, who you've gone through probably one of the hardest things in your life with. And they become good friends. They become like brothers. And it's not just, you know, the folks that you did the challenge with, but it's all the folks who have all done GORUCK challenges. The way I look at it, I have brothers and sisters in just about every city in the country and several of the major cities of the world, just that I could call upon if ever needed, because we share that bond, if that makes sense.
No, it totally makes sense. I mean, we're talking over the internet.
Yeah.
And we've never met.
Yeah, exactly. So,
you know, I always say that, you know, strangers are just best friends you haven't met yet.
yes, that is, and that is definitely something I believe in as well. So, yeah, for sure. Oh yeah, yeah. We've talked all about GORUCK, and I haven't even talked about it.
No, not a problem. Why don't you give some background about yourself?
I'm a writer. I live in St. Paul, Minnesota, with my 6-year-old daughter and my beautiful wife of 8 years. We have a beautiful home, an 1886 Victorian, which, unlike most homes around that period of time, was built by a woman by the name of Sarah Chapin. You know, it's this big, beautiful, you know, Queen Anne painted lady, you know, just have the dog, have three cats, you know, and just kind of, you know, have a business with my wife where most of my income comes from my writing and things related to it. The several books I've written, the blogs I write, yes, multiple. You know, other odd things I do. Then I also do technical consulting on the side with a focus on Macintosh, and that's a business that I've had on my own for, wow, over 10 years, but my wife and I decided to merge our solo consultancies into a LLC at the beginning of the last year because, it saved us a ton of money in taxes. So by a ton, I mean almost $10,000.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a big chunk of change. So, and that's worked out pretty well, even though some of our clients do overlap, but only very, very slightly. She's a nonprofit arts management consultant, a nonprofit and arts management consultant. And so, yeah, she helps very small nonprofits kind of handle the business end of things that they otherwise do not have the resources or talent to do. And so, yeah, we both work for ourselves, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, that's really the life, isn't it?
It is, you know, but it's not necessarily a dream life that a lot of people might cook it up to be. I mean, it is for us. I don't know that it's for everybody, because keep in mind that when you decide to work for yourself, all of those things that you got used to an employer doing for you, and that's the trade-off, is that, you know, working for somebody, they take care of a lot of stuff. You know, you kind of show up and you do the job that you're assigned, and you do that for 40, 60, 70, 80 hours a day, and, you know, or a week. And at the end of it, you get this paycheck that more often than not these days automatically gets dropped into your bank account. So you don't even have to take the check to the bank. You don't even have to sign them. It just shows up. And for a lot of people, that's a very easy dream life, because the alternative is, well, you do all that stuff yourself. You have to chase down the money. You know, you have to ask for it. You have to make things with the expectation that you will get paid for it eventually. You have to, you know, all that stuff that gets HR, insurance, you know, taxes, all of that stuff you're dealing with in some way, shape, or form, some manner. All of that stuff is not just being done for you. And that's, you know, that's the trade-off. I mean, believe me, there have been days when I've been like, gosh, man, I should just You know, I'd make a good barista at Starbucks, I think. You know, I'm personable. I'm nice. You know, I can keep a smile on my face even when dealing with the most difficult of people. I can just kind of deal with them. You know, I think I'd be a good barista at Starbucks, actually. The problem is it doesn't fit into my schedule because, like, you know, they generally need people to come in at 5 and work until 2 or something like that. And, you know, I actually value my time with my family too much. For me, what I'd like to say is I'm both a horrible boss and a horrible employee. So I'm best working on my own, actually. but yeah, I've been living that dream for, well, 6 years now, as far as working for myself.
So what does working for yourself mean to you?
Gosh, freedom, flexibility. You know, I kind of decide my own schedule. I can take on as much work as I need to and leave the rest behind. You know, I really, really, really love what I do. You know, I think ideally what we all want to find is we want to find a way to get paid for something that not only we love to do, but that we, and not that only that we never get tired of doing, but that we almost can't help ourselves from doing, right? That what I get paid for is a byproduct of things that I would be doing anyway, right? That I would be doing for no money. I would happily do for free if it came down to it, right? And I think a lot of people miss that point. A lot of people miss there's the kind of cult of do what you love, right? That's increasingly vocal, especially in an economy where jobs are difficult to find. You know, I think it's real easy for people to get caught up in that dream and in that mantra when, in fact, I don't think it's so much do what you love, although that's part of it. I mean, you're going to love it, but, you know, do what you do. Do what you do anyway and see if there's a way you might be able to get paid for that. And if you don't be too unhappy about it. If it just stays some hobby that you just do because of it, well, that's the way it is. You know, I think that, you know, in this world, anyone can build a business out of virtually almost anything. The key is that it takes a lot of hard work and it takes a long time. You're not going to just quit your job and leave tomorrow and suddenly have, you know, tens of thousands of dollars a month falling into your lap. It's just not going to happen. It might happen for some people. There are those rare exceptions. I mean, heck, I've got a friend who won the lottery. I mean, literally won the lottery. And guess what? He's still showing up at his job every day. You know, I mean, and, you know, so why? Well, you know, because he knows that that's actually the key to that money sticking around, right?
Yeah, definitely.
I think I'm in a really kind of much different place from a lot of people that would be in that sort of situation. I started off in a much different place. I was a full-time single dad to my two sons. I have two adult sons for, you know, essentially 10 years. And because of that, I mean, there were many, many days when I was so broke. We were so poor that I would literally have to decide, plan out when the one meal I was going to be able to eat that day would happen in order to make sure that I was not too hungry and, you know, still would go to bed hungry knowing I would wake up in the morning and not be able to afford to eat until probably 2 or 3 in the afternoon and that would be my one meal of the day. I mean, it sounds crazy, but yes, you know, but I did that so that my sons could have 3. But, you know, during that time, I worked really, really hard to make sure that I kept my debt really super low and kept my overhead really super low because I didn't have that you know, there's two ways to have more money. You can either make more, which, you know, I was working so much. I was literally working three jobs to just make ends meet with what I had, or to spend less. And that's what I did. I spent drastically less, and I managed to keep a roof over our heads and a car in the driveway, and managed to make sure that my sons never missed a meal, and managed to make sure that they got anything that they needed. And so when I did finally, you know, get married and, you know, kind of things turned around greatly as far as our income and ability and such like that, and it didn't change my relationship to debt. You know, as it stands right now, we have three houses that we own outright. We have three cars, well, two cars and a truck that we own outright. We have credit cards, sure, but guess what? We pay them off in full every single month. We keep our overhead really, really, really low. And because of that, we don't need to make a lot of money in order to survive. And I think that's another part of the equation that often gets overlooked, is that it's not just about having a dream and chasing it. It's also about doing everything you possibly can, doing all the upfront work to facilitate that dream so you have the freedom and ability to chase it. So you don't have to worry about, oh, I've got this bill to pay or that mortgage or this credit card or this student loan or this, that, or this, this, right? Because when you're in that situation, you're nothing more than a middleman. You're transferring money from one big major corporation, i.e. the one that you work for or whatever. You know, you're trading someone else's money. You're taking someone else's money and you're giving it away to another big corporation, right? You are just a middleman. You are a transfer station for that money. In order to get out from under that, you have to, you know, hey, you have to cut off the supply on one of those ends before you can cut off the supply on the other, or I should say, cut off the feed on one of those ends so you can cut off the supply on the other. All of that was a big roundabout explanation to say, yes, I'm living my dream, and I'm doing it because of a lot of hard work and a lot of sacrifice for a lot of years before I was able to get to that point.
I think that it's really awesome that you are smart enough to know that you have to cut down overhead to make all that happen. Because like you said, there's, you know, it said it takes a lot of money to make these dreams happen, but there's always another way, and that's to reduce the cost to make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you put it beautifully and hopefully inspire somebody to look at themselves and to cut down on what they've got in order to, and I don't know if sacrifice is the right word, but in some cases it probably is the right word,
mm-hmm,
for them to make it what their goal is.
Yeah. Well, and that's part of the, you know, and that doesn't come like, that's not something you do after you make that leap. That's not something you do after. That's the thing you do for years before you make the leap. You kind of set things up that way. Because, I mean, if you were to look at what my wife and I pay ourselves, because, you know, we, with the way that our business is set up, it's a LLC that's taxed as an S corp. It's a business, and it's a business that has a payroll, that, and we're the two employees of that business, if that makes sense, right? And so we cut a paycheck to ourselves from that business every month. And if you saw what that was, most people would laugh. Most people would say, there's no way I could live on that amount of money, right? But we don't pay ourselves any more than we need to, right? I guess, you know, that's a big part of it. You know, take a look at, you know, what is it that you need absolutely bare minimum every month to be able to live. Before we got married, my wife and I, we took this great course by a woman by the name of Ruth Hayden. And Ruth Hayden has has a book called, for, I believe it's called For Richer, Not Poor, The Money Book for Couples. And it was a great course because basically one of the biggest causes of divorce and of breakups and things like that is actually disagreements over money or come down to money struggles causing so much stress that it bleeds out into other places, right? And so we kind of knew right off that we wanted to get on the same page when it came to money. Took this wonderful course. But one of the kind of nicest ideas that came out of that course was just for a month, and anyone can do this. This is great. Just for a month, track everything that you spend money on. You know, the bills and stuff like that, yeah, for sure. But those are going to be fixed costs. Look at all of the other little things that you buy, you know, the cup of coffee at Starbucks, the gas at the gas station, each individual track what they individually spend. Take the bills out of the equation, just what you individually spend. All right. And once you've done that for a month, there you go. That's the cash that you are going to take out of the bank, you know, or out of your paycheck or whatever for the following month, right? And if you just have that amount in cash, whatever that is, what you'll find is you're a lot more conscious of how much money you actually have and are spending, and, you know, because you kind of see that wad dwindling down. You know, it's a very physical representation. It's really easy to get lost when you're dealing with cards, you know, debit or credit cards or whatever, that kind of mindset gets lost. But if you have it physically, you can really see it. But the other part of it too is that now suddenly you're making some hard choices. You're thinking, oh, that nice blouse or that I saw on sale at the store, gosh, it was only $10, but if I spend this $10, I now have to give up two of my Starbucks things this month. Or, you know what I mean? Like, you know, I have to skip Starbucks for 2 days. And you start to really kind of learn what it's like to make those sorts of choices between, if I do this, then I have to give up that. Do that for a few months, and you'll find you get really, really, really good at at living within your means, and knowing exactly what you're trading for the random money choices you make. Tremendously helpful advice. Highly recommend it. So yeah, I mean, it is. It's you know, there's a lot of sacrifice and a lot of kind of upfront stuff, you know, that you have to be. Plus, you have to be a really good, like I said, you're running a business, so you have to be prepared to run a business, even if that is just a business of one. You have to be ready to, you know, to be the one who counts the money, to be the one who goes and invoices for the money, to be the person who, you know, who sets their own price, who then, you know, has to pay taxes on that, who then has to, all of those things that you used to be able to not track, now you're tracking every single expense. You know, you're tracking the apps that you buy and the computer books that you purchase if you're a computer consultant. Why? Well, because, well, you get to write that off your taxes. You better track that stuff. I mean, yeah, you're doing all of those things that normally a business does for you if you work for one.
So what would you say inspires you?
My little girl, you know, if you look at all of my writing, you will see her there. You know, a lot of what I'm writing to future her, because I don't think that the world is getting any less complicated when it comes to living a life. Yeah, so that inspires me. I'm inspired by just the day-to-day living and conversations I have. Yeah, as a writer, you know, one of the things I try to explain to people, and I don't think anyone who's not a writer really gets it, is that I'm never not writing. I'm always writing. That everything that I experience, every moment, every second, everything I see, everything I smell, everything I taste, every conversation I have, every word that passes through my brain or comes out of my mouth, every one that I hear, that's all part of the writing. It all ends up in the writing. It's all kind of intertwined with the writing. And so, you know, people may ask, well, you know, when do you take a vacation? Never. Because even my vacations are part of my experiences, and those experiences end up in what I do. And quite frankly, I don't want any job that I can leave behind, right? I don't want any job that I'm not doing in some way, shape, or form all the time, or working on in some way, shape, or form all the time. That's just not who I am or how I'm built. You know, and so that's, you know, that's all inspirational to me, I guess you could say. Incredibly inspired by my wife too. But I should say that my wife is actually, I mean, she's friggin' amazing. If you know, you want to talk to someone who works her butt off for, I mean, first of all, she makes easily four times what I do. she is in incredibly high demand, incredibly well respected, and the what she is able to bring to the table, the wealth of skills and talent that she brings to the table. When a small organization hires my wife, they really are hiring, getting what other larger organizations usually do with between 5 and 10 people. And she works incredibly hard, and she is incredibly smart and incredibly, she's really super inspiring.
Well, maybe you can convince her to come on the show.
I should actually. Although she wouldn't have the time. I mean, that's part of it, right? Is that she works her butt off. She really does. You know, the trade-off though is that I'm the one who does a lot of the stuff that, like, I'm the one who, you know, drives Beatrix around to her various places and schedules and such. Beatrix being my daughter. I'm the one who, you know, runs out to Menards at 8 in the morning to go pick up posts for the guy who's putting in replacing the fence at our other house. I'm the guy who washes the dishes. I cook all of our meals. I, you know, I'm that guy. I mean, in a lot of ways, you know, my work allows me to do that because it's a very kind of solitary homebody sort of position, but in a lot of other ways, what it means is that I'm doing, you know, she's working a more than full-time job, and I'm doing all the other stuff that can't get done otherwise because of that.
So you touched on it a little bit before, but how did your dream of becoming a writer come about?
Well, I mean, I've been writing for most of my life. I actually published a really horrible book of poetry that will never see the light of day beyond the solitary copy that I know to be in existence downstairs in my basement, buried deep, I might add, because it really is that bad and that embarrassing. But I was 16 and full of angst, and, you know, like any angst-ridden 16-year-old writer, you write a lot of angst-ridden 16-year-old poetry. But I figured out a way to self-publish it. My grandmother actually had published 3 books, and so I knew a small press publisher through my grandmother, and, you know, my grandmother helped me talk to him about publishing this little book of poetry for, you know, basically a vanity project that I got like 200 copies of and sold them for like $5 a piece. And it was just a very arrogant 16-year-old thing to do. But I like to think that I was well ahead of the self-publishing curve, 30 years ahead of it, in fact. So, I mean, it's something that I've done for a very long time. I used to, as a young man, publish a zine with a friend that we would write up, put out there, send to other friends and family and stuff like that. You know, as soon as the internet came along, I, you know, immediately was thinking about, oh, geez, how can I use this to write? You know, and there were blogs, and, you know, I've been doing my blog for a long time. I was working, you know, at the time I actually was able to make the leap. You know, I was working at Carleton College. Carleton's a private four-year liberal arts school about 50 miles south of the Twin Cities area. It's a really, really good, really expensive school. It's like $60,000 a year. No joke. But let's just say that if you come out with a degree from Carleton, you can, you know, it's like one of the Midwest Ivies, as it were. It's up there with Grinnell and other ones like that. So was working at Carleton. I was kind of their head Mac guy there. I managed a team with a kind of a Mac expert, Windows expert, and kind of a hardware expert. The three of us were kind of the top level support for the college. It just so happened that they were making some organizational changes within the IT department there that was going to leave me doing work that I didn't want to do because of my relationship with my wife and our financial abilities. Without going into too much detail, it was a situation where I didn't have to work. And so basically I told them, I said, look, you know, you're essentially changing my job description. You're actually eliminating my position and creating this new one that has responsibilities that I don't care to do. I said, so there's two ways we could work this out, because I'm not going to do that job. And since I don't have to work if I don't want to, I'm not going to do that job. So there's a couple of ways we can work this out. Way number one is you've effectively eliminated my position, thus laying me off. Thus, I could collect unemployment, which perfectly fine by me. Or I have a daughter about to be born. You have 12 weeks of paid paternity leave. I could just take those 12 weeks and hand in my resignation at the end of it. And that's what I did. because, you know, I talked with Bethany about it, and Bethany was like, well, you know, we're in a good place. Beatrix is about to be born. You know, we were talking about, I mean, it was a hour commute each way to work. And so there were times when I wouldn't get out of work until 6:30. I wouldn't be getting home till 7:30. Here I come along with a brand new daughter that I want to spend more time with. I mean, there was that just wasn't going to work anyway. And so, you know, Bethany was like, hey, if you want to, you know, take a stab at doing the writing and consulting thing, this is a perfect time to do it full time. And so that's what we did.
Well, you kind of walked right into the next question, which is, how was your dream of writing received by your family? It seems like growing up, your family was very supportive of you being a writer.
Yeah. Well, and that's because I come from an arts family. My mom was in theater and a professor of theater. So she was a professor at the University of Iowa for many, many years and was very active in theater around the Twin Cities. And the Twin Cities is number two in the country for theater, right behind New York, slightly bigger than Chicago. And so, yeah, theater is really big here. She was an actress and director. My grandmother, her mother was a concert pianist. My dad is a freelance audio engineer and has been working for himself for 30, 40 years. So, yeah, I come from a family of artists and at least one engineer who are used to non-traditional jobs, ways of income, ways of making it. Although both my mom and grandmother were very much establishment after a bit. My mom wasn't at first. My dad still to this day continues to, he lives in D.C. and does freelance audio engineering. He's worked for himself for years and years and years and years. So yeah, it's not something that was foreign to my family, and certainly wasn't foreign to my wife, who had recently made a similar leap herself.
So what steps did you take to get started once you're like, okay, now I'm out of a job, I got this kid, I don't have to be working, go.
Well, I mean, what was nice was I had my consulting business for a long while, before I met Bethany, but I had always done it kind of on the side. I did try to do it as my full-time thing for 1 year, and that year was actually that was the year when I was having to make choices and decisions about my meal planning for the sake of my children. I literally made, and this is an exact figure, this was my gross for the entire year, $18,685. That was my gross for an entire year as a full-time single father. So I just want to put that into perspective and let that sink in a little bit, because that's so far below the poverty level that it's a mystery as to, even to me to this day, as to how we didn't end up homeless. And the only way, the help of family and friends, you know, especially friends who would know my situation but would never make me feel bad or like a failure, and would do things like, you know, invite us over to dinner, knowing that, oh, okay, terrific. That's, you know, food that I don't, you know, that's a meal I don't have to buy, right? Things like that. But it also helped that, you know, by that time I had really worked hard to reduce my overhead before I gave that a shot. But at the end of that, I got I got the offer from Carlton and went to work there. And Carlton had not only paid me more than fairly, but had tremendous benefits. I mean, really good. So there was that. Yeah. So basically, I was already in a good position because I had this existing business. I had the client base for it. It was just a matter of building on that already existing base. And so for a lot of people that want to do this, it's not a matter of just quitting your job and walking off and wandering into this giant pile of cash. It's actually sometimes working two jobs, three, whatever, doing whatever it is that you're doing on the side for a while to kind of build up that base, that clientele, that, you know, whatever it takes. You know, if you look around the internet at, you know, guys who are, you know, successful bloggers, you know, making money off their blogs, they didn't do that overnight. They were working real jobs. Many of them are working real jobs and doing that on the side and trying to figure out a way to flip that switch, as it were. And so, yeah, that's part of it. I already had this existing base upon which to build. It was just a matter of building it.
Did anybody ever tell you should be an accountant?
Oh, no. I really shouldn't be. But that's part of what my wife brings to the table. So she manages the money for our business and for several small nonprofit organizations around town. Yeah, let's just say that I've read a lot about money and I have been through a lot. When my first wife and I got divorced, I don't think I was ever really bad at money. I guess I was. I kind of, if I had money, I would spend it as a young man. I kind of was bad with being able to save money and being able to plan and things like that. And so because of that, I thought my first wife was really good with money. And I literally would just give my paycheck to her. I would literally sign it over to her. I didn't even want my name on a bank account. I didn't have any credit cards. I didn't want my name on a bank account. I just wanted to give all my money to her and just let her manage it. And then if I needed money, she would give me money, blah, 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 right? Well, what I found out was that she wasn't all that great with money. And by the time of our divorce, we were actually $40,000 in debt that we had to figure out because of the fact that I literally just signed my paycheck over to her and let her manage things and didn't really know the status of things. It kind of came out of our divorce that she would assume all of that debt. But of course, because my name was on some things and whatnot, my credit was virtually destroyed. So I couldn't get a credit card even if I had wanted to. I couldn't, you know. And so I had to figure out, because she wanted out. She wanted to not be married anymore. She didn't want to be a full-time mom anymore. I got the house. I got the car. I got the kids. I got the furniture. I mean, she just wanted to walk away. I'm like, fine. If you want out, that's terrific. Take your debt with you. And she did. You know, kudos to her for, you know, I don't know, growing up here and manning up. yep. But I did go there. you know, so I kind of walked out of it in a good place. I didn't have this big, large debt, but in a bad place, which turned out to be a good place, and I couldn't accrue more. I couldn't get a credit card to accrue more debt. And so I was forced to work with what I had, which, you know, at the time I did have a job when that happened. You know, I had a regular paycheck and whatever, and that was good. And it was certainly enough to kind of pay the mortgage and, you know, pay for food and gas and other expenses. It wasn't a whole lot. It wasn't, but it was certainly enough to sustain my two sons and I. And she was giving me a little bit extra in child support. Not what she was supposed to be, by the way. She never paid me what she was supposed to in child support, but that's a whole other story and all water under the bridge now. So I wasn't getting a ton of help that way, but it was something. You know, so I was forced to live within my means and figure it out and work with what I had. There were some books that really helped me, one of them being Your Money or Your Life. Highly recommend that book. That book, most of what I think about money today and how I approach it and how I approach my relationship with it can be traced back to that book. So no, I shouldn't be an accountant. It just so happens that I've had to learn a lot of what I've had to learn the hard way and think that that's a perfectly good school to go to.
So, I mean, obviously you've had a lot of roadblocks in life, but let's talk about specifically with writing.
Well, I'm lucky. I'm really lucky. We live in an age where a writer can certainly take matters into their own hands. We're no longer in this age where you write this thing and then in order to put it out into the world, you need some blessing from some publisher, big or small. You need someone else to buy into it and to sell it and to market it and to grow an audience for you, that you have all the tools at your disposal to grow your own audience. And then once you have grown that audience, give them things that will help them, things that will entertain them, things that matter to them. And then charge them for those things because they are happy to pay for them just as we are happy to pay for the things that do those things for us, right? I'm more than happy to pay for just about anything that Neil Gaiman puts out or that my friend Kelly McCullough puts out or that insert author that you like here puts out. Why? Well, because I get that much, if not more, return on value from that. They entertain me or they help me in some way. And so, yeah, we live in this really unique age where there really is no excuse for a writer not to make money. I'm pretty serious about that. I don't mean to sound like pompous or, oh, that's okay for you to do it. No. You can write something and you can sell it to one person and boom, there you go. You now have $10 more or $5 more or $2 more, whatever price you put on it, than you had yesterday. And guess what? Now you're a professional writer.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, I don't want to say funny, but it's interesting that you say that because in the face of newspapers falling out of the sky.
Yeah.
And publishers not really doing, I mean, I've talked to other friends of mine and basically they've told me that publishers don't do anything that they don't expect you to already do for yourself, except they get a 30% cut.
Yeah. And that's on top of the 30% cut that Amazon and whoever else is going to take from your ebooks or your, you know, I mean, in this day and age, there are very few reasons why I would ever tell anyone to go with a major publisher. And I would say that you're better off. You know, well, let me just put it this way. Of the two physical books that I have done, I still keep the majority of that money. There is not a single writer that I am aware of working for a major publisher or writing for a major publisher that can say the same. They can say that they keep the majority of the net of their book sales. They make money other ways. Take a look at Stephen King. Stephen King probably, my guess would be is that he's got one of the best book deals in the business. And my bet is that he does not keep the large slice of the sale of every book. That even if we're talking, even if he gets 49%, I get more of a percentage off of mine. You know, now that's great for him because he, that's not where he's making his money, right? He's making his money in a lot of other ways, not the least of which is movie deals, right? You know, then that's money that he gets to keep completely. And the same thing is true for, I mean, musicians, right? Musicians aren't making money off of MP3 sales or album sales or CD sales. They don't make, they haven't made money like that for years, right? Those things are promotional tools to sell other things, right? They're there to sell tickets to the tour. They're to sell, you know, they're to sell other things. They're not to sell. It's not about the music itself. It's about all the other things that they can make money off of that they get to keep. Britney Spears doesn't make a ton of money off of the MP3 sales, but, you know, her residency in Las Vegas has netted her something like $18 million in 3 or 4 months, right? You know, I'll take that deal all day long. So, yeah, I mean, that's basically what it comes down to. Writers, you know, who work for major publishers are, in a lot of cases, not making money off of those books. What they're making money off of is the other things that can come out of that. You know, that said, one of the many reasons why I work with a very small publisher, First Today Press, who's a longtime friend of mine, who cuts me a deal that is more than fair. You know, and the other books that I've self-published, I get to keep a big chunk of that change, as it should be, and any writer can. And seriously, if you want to be a writer and you've written something, you do the work, you put it out there for people to enjoy, you build an audience through that, you know, that is appreciative of that and is willing to buy some of that work from you.
So, I mean, while we're on the topic of books, let's talk about your books.
Okay.
Well, I mean, I have one sitting in front of me called Keeping It Straight. Well, you have another book. I haven't gotten it yet.
Yep, it's called Enough. That's another kind of physical book. I've got three other books that are lesser than those. Let's just say that. But they're also lesser priced, too, with the exception of one. But yeah, go ahead. So Keeping It Straight. Keeping It Straight was my first actual published book. Discounting that bad book of poetry that I did. Keeping It Straight is a kind of a collection of essays written over a several year period that covers a wide range of topic, each one of them with some nugget of wisdom that may brighten your day, may make you a little bit smarter, may help you out in some area of life, who knows. You know, there's a little bit in there about productivity. There's some personal stories in there. There's some stuff about mindfulness and minimalism, and that one's kind of a hodgepodge of various things that just kind of all fit and work together somehow.
Yes, you know, I definitely enjoyed reading it. It is definitely very inspiring for me, and I would recommend anybody that was interested in finding a bunch of stories, short stories. You know, they're pretty much all one page, aren't they? I think maybe
yeah,
two
they're mostly
pages tops,
1 to 2 pages. Yeah,
and I mean they share a lot of insights that you may have thought of at some point, but it puts it in a such a way that when you read it, it makes sense and sticks to you.
Yeah. I a lot of people ask me, one of the hardest questions I struggle with is when people ask me, what do you write? What do you write about? And it's a very complicated question because I write about life and I write about ideas and ways to approach that life and give it value and meaning, or I should say respecting the value and meaning that is already there, seeing it where it otherwise may not have appeared to you. And that's, you know, something that's really difficult to quantify into words or a soundbite, but I think Keeping It Straight definitely is one of is probably of the things I've written, that's the thing that most embodies that, the kind of breadth of stuff that I write about, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Can you share a favorite memory from all your writing?
So I'm writing this thing right now. I'm not even sure what it is. It's an idea that I started with 20 years ago, and it was just an idea. But it, number one, was so, I didn't have a firm grasp of the idea. It was just kind of a nugget. And so I kind of just put it on the back burner, and it just kept coming back around, this little idea. And every time it came back around, it would have a little bit more detail and say a little bit more to me about what it wanted to be. Or I would see something in the news or read something online or somewhere in some magazine or something that would trigger the idea again and add a little bit more to it. And it's literally been off and on like that for 20 years. And I never thought I could write this thing. I thought, okay, it's not my genre. It's kind of a sci-fi sort of thing, but not really, but kind of. I've got sci-fi friends, you know, guys that write, like published authors who do sci-fi. And like I even would shop it around to them. I'd even say, here's this idea I have. And it's just this kind of what if sort of idea. Let me throw it out there to you. And if you want it, if you think it's something, if it sparks your interest, you should write this, because I don't know if I can do it. And I don't think, it's not my skill set and blah, blah, blah. And I would tell them the idea and they go, no, that's a great idea that you should write. Yeah. Okay. I can't do this. And so about 4 weeks ago now, it came to me in a dream, the entire thing, out of nowhere. I suddenly had this dream where I saw the entire thing. And I woke up and I started writing this, and it's consumed me now for weeks, and I have no idea what it is. I don't know if it's going to be a book. I don't know if it's going to be a short story. I don't know if this is something that will ever see the light of day or if I'll be able to make any money off of it. I have no idea what it is. I just have to write it. And so, yeah, I guess that's a memory that immediately comes to mind, because so much of what I write comes to me already written. I know that sounds strange to a lot of people, and it's not like I just, well, no, it is. I sit down and like something takes over and it just comes out of me. And yeah, sure, I do some little bit of editing and maybe a little bit of rewording, you know, going back, but most of it not. Most of it, what you see is a first draft that just came out like that. So what's interesting, I think, about the thing I'm working on now is that also just came to me, but it actually is getting better as I write it, as I actually do the work. It's not coming out just kind of plopped onto the page. It's getting better and better and better every time I go back through it and rewrite it. So, yeah, I didn't mean to go off on a tangent there, but I'm kind of obsessed with it right now.
No, that's fine. I like the fact that you shared that. So if, you know, if I can have you on the show again, you know, 6 months, a year from now, we can revisit that.
Yeah, I can say, here's that thing. And I made absolutely no money from it. But oh, my gosh, was it so much fun to write.
So is there any parts of your dream that haven't quite worked out yet?
It's so hard to say, because I'm so thankful for what I have, because what I have is so much more than so many other people. You know, I don't say that to brag, and I don't say that. I say that to be humble, right? Because I've been in a really much worse place, emotionally and physically and financially and everything else. But right now, I'm not there. I have a wonderful life filled with friends and people that care, a wife who I just celebrated 8 years with this past Sunday, who I absolutely adore and respect and am awe of and worship. I've got a little girl who is just a joy and a pleasure and so much fun to be around, and just fills my life with just such happiness. We have our struggles like everybody else. Right now we're dealing with my little girl got lice at camp.
Aww.
And so spread to Bethany. Luckily, being both short-haired and African American, I have been spared thus far. But but you know, dealing with that, you know, we've had our challenges, we've had our struggles. It's funny. My wife and I actually went out to our anniversary dinner last night. So in lieu of a greeting card, we've started this practice where we write to each other in a notebook that we, you know, pass back and forth. You know, I wrote to her about all the wonderful joys and stuff like that that have been filled the past 8 years, and some of the, you know, great memories and wonderful travels that we've taken and things like that. But I said to her over dinner that I didn't want to write this in, you know, something, you know, that's supposed to be about, you know, the love and the joy and all of that. But we've also faced a lot of difficult things. You know, she lost her mother to cancer a year after we got married, you know, and we spent 3 weeks in literally by her side in the hospital room. Her mother, you know, died on Christmas Day in my arms, you know. you know, that, yeah, we've had our struggles, we've had our challenges, but even those have been valuable lessons and are part of our journey. And I look back on how we've come through those struggles and how we've come out the other side without killing each other, without, you know, and been the better for it. I'm incredibly blessed and lucky. I wish I could say that, oh, Joan, things are so hard and blah, 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 blah. But quite frankly, you know, each one of us has at best 100 years. That's nothing. It really isn't. You know, when you think about the fact that this, the universe has been around for, what, 15 billion years? Our planet, 3 billion? Human life on this planet, you know, tens of thousands, 100 years. Mm-hmm. Is nothing. It's extremely finite. None of it is guaranteed. One of my favorite recent thoughts on this is I've got a friend who has another friend, a neighbor down the street who has Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS. She was relating this story to me. He said that he loves it when, you know, kind of people come by the house and, you know, he, knowing his situation, knowing the finite nature of his life, you know, that maybe he'll be gone in 2 to 3 months. You know, they come in and they say, oh, you know, we're so sorry. And, you know, his response is, well, don't be sorry for me. I know when I'm going to die. I know exactly kind of how it's going to happen, even. I can tell you, like, everything there is to know about my impending death. You, on the other hand, have no idea when it's going to come. You could walk out that door and get literally hit by the proverbial bus. Guess what? I know that's not how I'm going to go because I can't walk. I can't go out the door. I'm not going to get hit by a bus. The fact is, I may live longer than you. It's putting it into perspective, most certainly. And it's the truth. I know it sounds cliche to live each day as if it's your last. But I can tell you for certain that I have known, I'm 46, I could rattle off half a dozen people, friends, people I knew well, that were there one day and gone the next. My friend Steve, who went out in the middle of winter to paint a garage that he had just built and had a bad heater, had a bad space heater in that garage, felt a little tired, thought it was just the late hour, didn't wake back up again. This is someone who I'd literally seen the day before and had given me a gift even, right? My friend Stacy, when I was a teenager, she was in college, went to a party, you know, she was not a wild party girl, but was at this party and someone offered her some Coke and she thought, you know, okay, I'll try it. Dead. Had a bad reaction, had a heart attack, died literally within minutes. So I know it sounds cliche. I don't have any fear of death because I know that death is coming. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. As a matter of fact, death is the one constant in this universe. anything that is born will die. This planet will die. This galaxy will die. Our sun, die. The universe eventually will die. Anything that lives dies. It is perhaps the only universal truth there is. And quite frankly, all of those things I just rattled off will live far longer than any, literally thousands of times, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of times, billions of thousands of times longer than we will. So for me to complain about any single thing in my life is all wind and sails, man.
So what do your dreams for the future look like?
Lovely follow-up question. Lovely follow-up question.
Thank you.
Oh, geez. You know what? My dreams for the future look like this. I hope that when I get off this call, I have just enough time for lunch. And then I'm going to send a text to our friend who's building the fence for us, and I'm going to check in and see if he needs any help. And if anything, my dream is to have a new fence at some point by the end of the day today or tomorrow. That's my dream. And that is to say that I'm too busy concentrating on right now and a few moments from right now for me to, if I were to say, what are my dreams for the future? Gosh, I hope that Beatrix grows up in a world that's still here. That would be nice. I'm super kind of, worried that's not going to be the case. For a number of reasons, not the least of which is, we've got a very serious problem on our hands with climate change, and we've got all of the technology to, I don't know, make some immediate and quick changes, but none of the people willing to get together and talk about it and put down their differences and get the work done. We could power this entire planet with solar panels that would take up so little space in the middle of the desert in Africa that, if you were to see it from a satellite, you couldn't even see it from space. You wouldn't be able to see it with the naked eye. Yet, is that happening? No. Elon Musk just released all the technology needed to make completely clean electric vehicles available to anyone. We could all be driving Tesla technology in every single one of our cars, and Chevrolet and Ford and all of the auto manufacturers could switch their entire vehicle fleet to it tomorrow. Not going to happen. So, these are things I worry about, I suppose. My dreams for the future are that my daughter grows up to have the ability to live hers, that my sons continue to find their way as adult young men in an increasingly difficult world for adult young men, especially adult young men of color, who have not received all of the education that was made available to them. I mean, these are the sorts of things I hope for, I guess. But right now I like to, go with the Warren Zevon quote, getting back again to death. Warren Zevon, musician most famously known for Werewolves of London, was a frequent guest on the David Letterman show. He got brain cancer, knew he only had a few months to live. Dave invited him on for a final kind of farewell performance. They didn't dwell too much on the fact that, he was dying, but Dave said, we kind of know what's going on, and kind of on the other side of this, they say that, if you kind of know this stuff, you get this great wisdom and, things like that. Is there anything that you've learned any final kind of thoughts you'd like to impart or anything like that? And Warren Zevon just kind of said, just kind of shrugged his shoulder and said, well, I guess just enjoy every sandwich. Enjoy every sandwich. That's the only dream I have.
Before we get to your last thoughts, which I assume you have more to say than enjoy every sandwich. Let's talk about, because you have so many, and I know we're running extremely long.
I'm sorry.
No, don't be sorry. I love hearing your stories and the struggles that you've dealt with over the years, and it really puts a lot of things into perspective, especially as a fan, to hear these stories. So, let's get to your blogs. You got Minimal Mac.
Yep. Minimal Mac, patrickrone.com. The Cramped, which is my blog that's kind of focused on paper and pens and typewriters and sort of analog writing tools. Yeah, I've got a few. I ghost write a blog for my daughter. I've got a Tumblr called The Random Post. I've got a lot of sites.
Is it hard to keep them all straight?
But don't bump. No, it's not hard to keep them all straight. And there's a reason why that some are separated from others, right? You know, there are some topics like the intersection of technology and simplicity with Minimal Mac that I feel are large enough and deep enough for me to spend years exploring just that topic. Like there's enough to wrap that around a site, as it were. Same thing with The Cramped now. There's a lot of pen blogs out there. There's a lot of notebook blogs out there. There's a lot of, and they do lots of product reviews and things like that. And I don't knock them at all. As a matter of fact, I think, folks like Brad Dowdy, Anna Reichert with The Well-Appointed Desk, Brad Dowdy does The Pen Addict. I think that there's a lot of room for that. I wanted to take a slightly different approach, not to say that I won't do some product reviews and have at The Cramped, but that my want to approach this from a actual usage and action perspective, like it, not just about the tools themselves, but like how they're used. I want to see things that are being used and loved, right? I want to, see handwriting. I want to see typing. I want to see like things being used. I don't know if that makes sense, but it does to me. And so, that's why I have a lot, because there are some subjects that I feel warrant it. For everything else, it goes on my personal site.
Yeah, I mean, the way I found out about you, I think, was tool.com. Reposted one of your posts for Minimal Mac.
Yeah.
And that's when I found out about you. And then you eventually started your own podcast, which was, I thought was great. Cause I listened to that episode with the two British fellows.
Oh, so Mike, who was always a host on the show, but, I don't know who the other one would have been. Terry Lucy or,
No, not on your show.
The Bro Show.
Right.
Yeah. That was Terry Lucy and Mike Hurley. Yeah.
And then you guys got together and started Enough, which was really good. I mean, some of my favorite things from that was the clothes hanger trick.
That works really well. I do that all the time.
It does, actually. I do it. I had to keep going back through it to prune, and it doesn't help when your weight goes up and down as mine does, because I'm a runner, but only part of the time.
yeah. Well, and so the clothes hanger trick, for those who are listening to this and aren't familiar, here's what it is. Once a season, take all your clothes that are on hangers. And even if you have some that aren't, maybe put them on a hanger and turn that hanger backwards in your closet. So instead of hanging it like in where you can grab it, hang it from the back, turn it around so the hook is coming from the back. Do that with all of them. Then as you go through the season, when you take out, clothes to wear, you take the, hanger. Now you kind of have to remove it backwards to get it out. But you take that off and you put it back in the right way, and you make sure to whatever you wear when you wash it, whatever, put it back on the hanger the right way. But basically what you'll find is that at the end of that, if you have anything that is still facing the wrong direction, that's the time to ask yourself whether or not that stuff you really actually need, because you're actually not using it.
Yeah, definitely. And I love it because it definitely brings clothes to the forefront that I thought I was wearing or going to wear and then never actually did.
Do, yeah. And there are going to be some things that you wear very infrequently. If you don't, especially if you work for yourself and you don't have the sort of thing where you're wearing a suit and a nice shirt all the time. Well, guess what? You still might need that suit and that nice shirt for the odd funeral that comes up, but I mean, you may not wear it for, a year. You know what I mean? Like, there are going to be some of those things. This is not to say that you should just throw all that stuff away. This is just simply to say, those are the things that you should be asking the question about. Do I need this? If so, why? What is its justification for being in my life? Or would it be better off in someone else's, at the Goodwill or giving it to a friend or whatnot? Things like that. And it works for a lot of other things, too. I find one of the most effective ways to clean a desk is to put a box at the end of that desk, take your hand, and sweep everything off of it into that box. Now your desk is clean in literally 10 seconds. And now, as you need things, you know, oh, I need a stapler. Oh, you go look in the box. You take out the stapler. You put the stapler on the desk or in the drawer where it belongs. But basically, you set a period of time, let's just say 2 months, 3 months, whatever it is. You set a period of time that everything that is left in that box at the end, that's the stuff I'm not using, or that's the stuff I rarely use, and maybe I need to reconsider whether or not I need this. I mean, it works for all sorts of things, all sorts of things. Applications. You want to see what applications you have installed that you're really actively using. Let's just take phone apps, for instance, because that's the one that I think a lot of us are guilty of. Just, oh, let me just buy this 99-cent thing to try it out, and then I can quickly forget about it. Well, now that Apple gives you folders, or take all those things and put them 2 pages away. Clear off your home screen, and then as you need things, before launching them, drag them back to your home screen, right? And you'll quickly find out which things you use most frequently and which things you really don't, and whether you should consider deleting them or not. You know, it's things like that. Basically, taking everything, putting it somewhere, and then as you use things, taking them out of that thing and then reevaluating at some specified point in time down the road.
Yeah, I mean, it creates like a physical checklist without recording every, hey, my blue shirt, haven't used that in a while.
Yeah, exactly.
But actually you did, you just forgot to record it.
Yeah. Or, you know, it's very visual too, these sorts of things. You can immediately look at that box and see how full it is. You can immediately look at your closet and see how many of those hangers are turned the opposite direction, you know?
Yeah. The other thing that I was always a big fan of was your final choices.
Yep. That's, something I still do and serves me very well. Final choices basically are this, and that is that a lot of things, when it comes to a lot of things, not everything, there are certain things that are meant to be replaced every few years, or things that are not built, you know, where there is nothing built to last. You know, someone's like, you know, how do you apply final choices to a toaster? Well, you don't. Toasters are not meant to last for 100 years. Toasters are generally built to last maybe 5 to 10. And so because of that, you can't apply it there. But like, you know, so an example I give is there's these boots. They're Red Wing boots. They're very expensive Red Wing boots. Red Wing boots are in general very expensive. Why are they expensive? Well, they're expensive because they're extremely well made. Why are they extremely well made? Well, they're made to last. And they've been made to last for a very long time. And I could, I don't know, buy a, you know, $20, $30, $40, $50 pair of boots that serve me for a few years that I'll have to replace in a few years, or I could make the final choice of just buying this one pair of $300 boots. Ultimately, I'm spending the same amount of money as either 10 pairs of the $30 boots or one pair of the, but guess what? I don't ever have to think about a pair of boots again now. I've made the final choice, and the choice is that pair of boots. And as long as I take care of them, and if, you know, the sole wears through, they will replace the sole. You know, Red Wing Boot Company is a company that's been in business for 100 years and probably be in business for 100 more, over 100 years, actually. And they will resole, replace whatever fails on that boot for, you know, next to nothing. So why not? And that's the same thing, you know, with getting back around to GORUCK, right? When those who are not familiar with GORUCK go and look and see what their Special Forces grade backpacks cost, they're probably going to hiccup a lung. Because, you know, their, you know, kind of middle of the road average backpack is $300. But guess what? It's the last backpack you'll ever have to buy. you're never going to have to buy another backpack. That backpack will last a lifetime, and they have a lifetime guarantee on it. They will repair or replace it in perpetuity or however long they last. Because that's the other thing you have to look at when you're looking at Final Choices 2. And one thing I don't think I touched on very well, which is it's not just a matter of looking at the product, it's also a matter of looking at the company, right? Because a lifetime guarantee from a company that only is around for 2 years isn't going to help you. Right?
It helped them.
it might help them, but it's not going to help you. And so I'm very careful about that. You know, I think I could reasonably see GORUCK being a 100-year company. I could easily see, you know, obviously Red Wing has already been a 100-year company. It's going to be a 200-year company, right? Why? Well, because that's, you know, I've looked at the company. I've done more than just looked at their boots. You know, making a final choice is about looking at everything, looking at the company, looking at the warranty, looking at the, you know, because you want to do all this work up front so you don't have to do it every single time again. So you only have to do it once.
So is there any last thoughts you'd like to share?
And I can't pick and enjoy every sandwich, especially being that that's not my thought. I think if anything, this is a very, very, very short life, as I've already laid out. There's a multitude of ways you can spend it. You can spend it wrapped in worry and suffering and doubt and loathing and hating and all of these negative emotions. Or you can spend it looking around at the very fact that you get it in the first place and finding happiness there, finding joy there. Letting that alleviate your suffering and alleviate your worry. Quite frankly, you know, I hate to tell you this, but not paying your mortgage will get you kicked out of your house, but it's a short life. You don't have to worry about that for too long. I'm not saying that you shouldn't pay your mortgage, you should, but just saying that most of the things that we make a big deal out of, really, in the grand scheme of things, not so big of a deal. And if you really want to measure your success, money is the worst way to do it. Right? Someone actually said to me today, the actual phrase, you know, well, time is money. I said, no, you're incorrect. Time is far more valuable than money. Money is a construct. Money doesn't exist. Time is very real. One of those things you can always get more of. Time is not one of those things. You can always get more money. You cannot get more time. There is none. It is finite. It is the most finite and most valuable resource in the world, in the universe. So no, time is not money. So, if anything, yeah, final thought, be conscious of your time. It's the most valuable thing you have. Enjoy it.
That was very beautifully put. Thank you.
No problem.
It was an honor having you on the show and to be the longest show.
I'm sorry.
No.
You shouldn't have known from listening to enough that I can talk.
No, I know. No, I really appreciate you sharing all the stories, and I mean, it's extremely inspirational. Thank you so much, and I would love to have you on the show again in 6 months to a year, and we'll see how you're making out then.
I would love that.
I'll put all your blogs and your Twitter accounts and your Facebook pages all
and all
the,
that stuff. Yeah.
All in the show notes.
All right. Sounds perfect. Thank you so much. This has been a lot of fun. Like I said, I enjoy doing these things. And not having a podcast of my own anymore, I don't get to do them enough. So thanks.
Thank you.
All right. Have a great one.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Dreamers Podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Dreamers Podcast. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/Dreamers Podcast. If you or someone you know would like to be a guest on the Dreamers Podcast, please send an email to j@jpar.co. This podcast is copyright 2014 by jpar.co.